W is going to come up and introduce our speaker tonight.
Huh.
Pat W, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Pat.
Hi, everybody. Had a while to think about this. And I guess the easiest way would be the simplest. 37 years ago, I met this guy. And I had a mentor in Las Vegas who was his best friend. And met him on a Saturday afternoon. The next night, he talked. For the first intergroup area meeting that we had, we just formed an intergroup in Las Vegas. And he was our first speaker. And I've told him this many times. Probably one of the main reasons I'm standing up here tonight is the message that he's carried in that length of time. Come on, get up here.
Jesus. My name is Clancy Imeslin. I'm an alcoholic. I guess I'm overly sentimental, but I was thinking, if I had one day left to live, someone said, what'd you like to do that last day? I think I'd like to spend it hearing Pat talk. I know it would make it seem like forever. I want to commend my friend Jan on her 40-year chip. Only one thing has kept me from getting a 40-year chip. Drinking. But I'm glad to be here tonight. Glad to be in Georgia. I've been here all day. We had a good time here. Not very many people. We had a good time. And we discussed those steps and those traditions. And usually they don't leave quite so early in my talk. And sponsorship. It was a good day, and I enjoyed it. And I heard myself talking about things that I many times have taken for granted. So it was good to go through that again. And now tonight we're at an AA meeting at the Howe Place. And I'm just always glad to stand up and remind myself from whence I came and why I'm here. Because it's very easy to take sobriety and all of its attendant blessings with for granted. I was talking to my wife this morning. It was a cold, drizzly morning in Los Angeles. And I was kind of, in a way, I missed being home, because on cold, drizzly mornings, they have a tendency to remind me again about, on a kind of a cold, drizzly morning, one morning I found myself in a situation that a person of my background and intelligence and ability cannot be in. Two big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission in downtown Los Angeles and said, and stay out of here, you damn bum. And I tried to explain to him, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I helped write were running that very week in Life and Time and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And besides that, unfortunately, about 3 or 4 weeks before that, I'd had my front teeth kicked out in the Phoenix drunk tank. So I wasn't hitting those consonants quite as cleanly as I'd have liked. But I stood outside of that Skid Row mission on a cold morning. And I felt dreadful. I remember it was so bad. I remember thinking years ago, it was so bad. I wondered briefly if maybe this was just a dream, that maybe any minute my wife would come and shake me and say, time to get up. Boy, you really been hollering in your sleep. It was a bad dream. But it wasn't a dream, and I stood there, and I didn't know what to do or where to go. If some old guy would have come over to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're getting down near death. You weigh about 115, 120 pounds. You've lost your family, your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your home. You had a nice home, a couple of nice homes you've lost. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you kind of a boy genius, and now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost your clothing somewhere between Dallas and here. All you got left is what you got on, and it's wet and dirty and torn. You've lost your front teeth. You can't even get a job if you had any decent clothes. You're an only child, and your mother is not allowed to accept phone calls from you anymore because your stepfather is so tired of watching you build up her hopes one more time with promises to get some money and then demolish them with your performance later. And you've been in and out of AA now for almost 10 years. Why, for God's sakes, don't you just shape up? Why don't you go back to AA, admit you're an alcoholic, and do something with your life? You know, some guy came over to me that morning, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I may or may not have been, most people who have ever been in desperate situations are aware that when you're back to the wall, honesty is not your number one priority. Your priority is, how do I get out of this? What do they want to hear? What shall I say? But if I were in a mood to be honest, I'd have probably had to tell him, it isn't the way it looks, pal. It isn't the way it looks. The reason I don't go to AA is because I'm not really an alcoholic. I wish I were. It would make my life so much more simple. I'm not an alcoholic. I know I got problems. I've known it since I was a little boy. But I'm not an alcoholic. And Peter said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I wouldn't have been able to do that. I wouldn't have had the objectivity to be able to stand back and evaluate myself, so I probably would have done what frightened people like me do when they get cornered. You take refuge behind bluster. And you say things like, get out of my face! Leave me alone, son of a bitch! Go away from me! Because I wouldn't have known the right answer. I know the right answer now, and I've known it for a lot of years. I gradually learned it in my own life, and I've watched it again and again in many people's lives. Because of a very simple reason. It wasn't anything dramatic or metaphysical or spooky. It's just that I've been going to meetings off and on for 10 years, and I knew what an alcoholic was, and I wasn't that. It was just that simple. No big deal. Which begs the question, well, what's an alcoholic? Well, everybody knows what an alcoholic is. People driving by out here who've never been to AA know what an alcoholic is. An alcoholic is one of those people, there seem to be a bunch of them in every generation, who drink, and they don't seem to handle drinking very well. They get drinking too much, and their lives get screwed up, and their emotions get painful, and they eventually get driven to some place like AA, and the AA sober them up, and then their lives get better. And I know that's true, because I heard it again and again and again. A lot of cities where I went to meetings from time to time, the specifics vary, lives all vary, but it's always that same story. You must admit that. My life was terrible drinking, then I got sober, and now I'm feeling better. And in the last analysis, that really was why I knew I wasn't an alcoholic. I drank like an alcoholic, been in jail like an alcoholic, been in hospitals, been in veterans' hospitals, been in regular hospitals. But the one difference between an alcoholic and me was always this. Unlike alcoholics, when I get sober and straighten out my stuff, that's when my life gets painful. And that's when my emotions get out of whack. And the longer I try to be good and the longer I try to be straight, the worse it gets. It almost gets like there's a big spring inside of me that just every just pushes it closer. And I get so tense and I get so irritable and I get so uncomfortable and angry and feel inadequate and feel so terrible. And I discovered when I was a boy, 15 years old, running away from home early in the Second World War on a ship in the middle of the Pacific. Some guys talked me into drinking some whiskey. And the first drink I was able to hold down, I discovered that's the best and surest way I've ever found to get rid of that feeling. And I drink, but I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. And if I don't drink, I can't stand it. And that's why I know I'm not an alcoholic. I wish I were. I wish I could be like these people. I've sat in these meetings in Chicago and San Francisco, New York and Minneapolis and Milwaukee and Dallas and El Paso, all sorts of cities where I worked. And they all seem to be nice people, but they're not like me. They're not like me. But nobody came over and talked to me that morning. I just stood there in the corner, and I thought, God, I got to get off this corner. I'm going to die. And I remember I'd spent a little time hanging around some AA club in Los Angeles called, it was on the, all I remember is the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, wherever the hell that was. So I asked somebody, where's the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax? They said, well, you're a long way. You have to, Wilshire doesn't come through. You have to walk up to Hill Street, then cut over to Wilshire, then walk west till you get there. So I said, okay. And I walked, and I walked, and walked, and walked, and walked, and walked in that rain. I counted later with my card, it was about 72 long blocks. That's a long walk when you're sick and tired and desperate. A lady in New York once upon a time asked me, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so sick and desperate? And of course, the answer is quite simple. That's the only time you can. You could never do it any other time. You could do it when you're sick and desperate. You got to do what you got to do. And I got near that club, and as soon as I saw it, I remembered why I'd left there. I had had terrible problems in there. I'd been in there a couple times drunk. And I denounced them and told them how lucky they were to be stupid and how lucky they were not to be intelligent. I told them I'd been around any longer than they were. I didn't want to go in, but I had to go to get out of this rain. And I didn't want to go in there. They weren't glad to see me, and I wasn't glad to see them. But I went in there. And not only was it a club, but it's the worst form of club. It was full of AA fanatics. I don't know anything more tedious to an intelligent slipper than to be thrust among AA fanatics. And they're living that life, first things first, keep coming back. Oh,
Jesus Christ.
I'll tell you what AA fanatics are like. I've had to sometimes, well, let me put it this way. I'm not a mooch. I've never been a mooch, except when I've had to be. I'm like a lion. I don't kill for sport. I kill for food. But, you know, sometimes these AAs are nice people. They're kind of simple. You have to kind of tell them how they can help you so they know how to help you. Well, let's help them, you know. So I might tell them, I'm a newcomer in AA, and I've come here for help. I know you can help me. I have no place. What did he say?
He wasn't going to touch me in my truck.
We don't have secrets in AA. Well, are you going to move your truck or not? Oh, he's moving it. I'll bet he is. Hey, I might say to these people, I watch your program, but I've no place to stay, and I'm cold and hungry. I have all I have is these wet clothes, and if I had some dry clothes, perhaps, and a place to stay that was warm and maybe a bite to eat, I really could find this program and find a new life. That's a little bit of a clue, wouldn't you think? Do you know what AA fanatics say? Go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out. Of course, the answer to that is, oh, gee, sir, you're number one with me. Well, I hung around that damn club, and that night they had a meeting. That night they had a meeting, and I ate about 4 pounds of cake. I listened to some hideous drivel about some guy who'd been got sober and felt wonderful. Then everybody went home. The club a little bigger than this, broken up some rooms, and everybody went home, and I was still there, and the guy was trying to close it up. It was still raining. I said, I have no place to stay. He said, you're looking for a dry place to get out of the rain? Yes, I am. So I've got just the place for you. Down the end of the parking lot, there's an old green 49 Merc. Somebody dumped it here last summer. That's really dry. You could sleep in there. That's what you got to give me a sleeping and a broken down. That's it. Gee, thanks. God bless you, sir. I slept in that stinking old car and it was cold. I got up in the morning and the club opened. I went in there. And it was Sunday morning and they had a spiritual meeting, even the worse than the one before, you know. And God brought me home. And I ate about 4 more pounds of cake and I hung around the meeting all afternoon. And that night there was another meeting and I hung. And this went on for days. I just thought, what's good? I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is hell. This is what I get for marrying that Catholic that time. And I had no idea then or thereafter for a long, long time that would be my sobriety date. And now it's been, a few months, it'll be 40 years since I walked off Skid Row. And all that time I haven't had a drink. I haven't had a pill of any kind, even though I'm rather sensitive. Just my luck, I had to work the program before Prozac came out. I don't judge. The people that I sponsor, when they tell me they've taken Prozac, I congratulate them on their new sobriety date. True story. But it all out, I don't suppose anybody ever slipped as long as I did, and now been sober as long as I have, who wouldn't look back and think, what was different this time? Of all the times I got sober, because I had less reason to stay sober this time than any time. I've stayed sober for good reasons, for jobs, for all sorts of things. What was different this time? And I thought about it many times. I think, what was different this time? I used to think, maybe I just really wanted to stay sober this time. Maybe I had a deep drive to stay sober. And the answer to that is absolutely not. Absolutely not. One time I tried to stay sober and I gave it all I had. When I was living in Texas, I was out drunk, got arrested overnight. I was arrested overnight a lot of times. I know a big prisoner, but I've got a smart mouth. And I'm always smarting off to cops and get thrown in jail overnight. And this night was the wrong night to be in jail overnight, because that night when they found me, they said, gee, you should have been home last night. Your little son died. And I felt so terrible, I couldn't stand it. I almost went crazy. And, God, it was just hideous. I had a bunch of little girls and this one little boy, so naturally he took on a little added luster because he's the only one of his sex in our family. And I felt so bad. Remember, relatives came from the funeral. You know, nobody said a word about my drinking or me being in jail. That, in a sense, almost makes it worse. You sit around the living room and they all smile. You can just see in their eyes, you dirty, rotten son of a bitch. Oh, terrible. And we buried that little boy. I put my hand in his casket surreptitiously. And I said, John Immersland, this will never happen to another child in this family, ever. And we were in Wisconsin then. I was just going down to work in Texas. I went down there to work, and I was so chastened. I didn't drink for a little while, and I watched my drinking very closely because drinking was such an integral part of my life. And eventually my family came down and joined me, and something happened. I referred to it earlier today. I could see that I took my inventory. Every time my family came in, the pressure was on, seemed to be more, and my drinking would increase. So my drinking increased, and I liked my job, and I liked the town, but there's a lot of pressure on me, I felt. And my wife had to finally say, Clancy, remember how bad you felt when you were in jail? God, don't let that happen again. I said, that's right. And so I stopped drinking. Stopped drinking with my dead son, John. Now, you may wonder, can people like us, if you have a good enough reason, can you stop drinking? And the answer is absolutely yes, you can. I stopped drinking. I went to meetings once in a while, but I didn't like them. Went to a psychiatrist for a while, read some books. But I stopped drinking. Unfortunately, if you're like me, and I presume like you, you discover eventually you can stop drinking for a while. And then it starts to unravel, little by little. And pretty soon, your old pals come back one night. Here comes irritability. and resentment and self-pity and anger. And little by little, you get more and more uncomfortable. And the reason to not drink is to not drink. And I wouldn't drink. But little by little, the job I had liked, I didn't like anymore. I thought they were a bunch of jerks. And I didn't like this town. And I didn't like the situation. My children, who I was doing it for, my little girls, I couldn't. They were noisy. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. Let Daddy alone. I'm sorry. Daddy isn't feeling good. Jeez. Mary, just take your sisters and go away for a little while. I'm sorry. And on and on. And that spring inside of me was just... But you can't drink when you've taken a vow on your son's casket. What do you do now? And I just couldn't make out what to do. Finally, one day my wife took the children to church. And I parked the car in the garage and hooked up a hose to the exhaust pipe and turned the motor and went to sleep and died. I didn't know what else to do. I just couldn't stand it. And a neighbor was watching us apparently from a window. Watched me go in there and he noticed the motor was running and I didn't come out. So he ambled over after a while and found me slumped across the wheel, apparently dead. And he went in and pulled me out and beat on my chest and they breathed in my mouth and they rushed me to the hospital and oxygenated me and examined me and determined I was seriously emotionally ill and moved me to a high security locked ward. They examined me some more and determined I was a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies and committed me for an indefinite period to the Texas State Insane Asylum at Big Spring, Texas. Now that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That's not a big goal of mine. Glenmore, we're going to get you sober. Oh, shit, no, you know. When I was committed there for a long time, I could have been there for the rest of my life, possibly. I was there about 2 weeks, and I was starting to feel better because I was protected from my pressure, I guess. I thought, what am I doing here? What a rotten, you know, stunt. I didn't mean to do that. And remember some guy said, don't try to escape from this hospital, boy. Can't run away from this hospital. Oh, shit. $60 a month attendant isn't going to stop me, baby. And I found a way finally to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over the fence, and I was loose. And as you get loose, you suddenly realize you cannot escape from this hospital. I don't know if you've ever been in West Texas, but you discover they can see you running for 3 days. And you feel like such a boob in your white bathrobe out there. Just just a matter of time of them. Why, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and gave me several months of 36 electric shock treatments for that run. And I'll tell you what, you've had a lot of electric shock treatments. You never run again for a long time. What's your name, boy? Check of the desk. So I was there, and I was just coming out of these dreadful shock treatments, and they looked at my record and seen that I directed an opera at the University of Texas. So they allowed me to direct the Christmas pageant that year at the Texas Nut House. A little, not a very complex production. The director's job primarily was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you possibly could. We just want to worship her, Clancy. Well, the next year, I start thinking, I ought to get out of here one of these days, you know. This is going to look bad on my resume just year after year in this nut house. And I didn't know what I was going to do. They made me a trustee, and I walked around after I was off those shock treatments, but couldn't get out. Never could get out, looked like. Then when I'd get close to getting out, somebody would irritate me, not explode or something. Bad marks again. And that spring and summer, much to my surprise, I didn't even know what was going on. A guy in that town had an idea. He felt that a lot of people in the insane asylums in Texas were there because of their drinking and alcoholism. and he begged them to give him an experimental place to try an AA, or an alcoholic ward. And that had been going on for 2 years. And finally, that year, while I was there, they let him have one half of one ward, nine, in the Big Spring Hospital to start set up an alcoholic ward. He wouldn't get paid for it, just to see if it would work. And they had a procedure in Texas where if your family would sign you into this ward, you'd have to go there, and you'd have to stay there 30 days. Then they'd have to release you. But they had you for 30 days. And so as soon as I found out there was an alcoholic ward with AAs in it, and my mind was coming back, I thought, God damn it, I know how to hustle AAs. At least I can pretend to be an alcoholic, maybe get out of here. So I went over and found Mr. Ross in my rounds one day. I said, Mr. Ross, I'm in here as a suicide commitment, but you know my problem has always been alcohol. My life is good, and I'm a fine person, but when I drink, it gets so bad that it's almost as though I have lost the ability to control my drinking. Do you have some sort of a book I could read, or are there any kind of meetings or literature I could follow? If I could just return to the God I've lost in the bottle, I know I could find peace. God, his eyes went... Poor man had never seen a sincere newcomer. He says, I'll get back to you, boy. And he never did for days. I thought that old fool has burned me off. But it turned out he had to go through Austin to get permission to whether a psychiatric commitment could go to the alcoholic ward. And I became the pilot study in the state of Texas to whether or not psychiatric commitments could go to the... And I went in there, and I was wonderful because I knew exactly what they wanted of me, and none of these other people did. So I played their sick little game better than anybody they ever had before or since, I'm sure. Mr. Ross would give us a talk on the 12 steps for an hour. He said, well, boys, today we're going to discuss the 12 steps. And, but I knew better than... Good, Mr. Ross. You get all done with this tedious lecture. Say, are there any questions? Nobody got any questions. Let's get out of here. Mr. Ross, could you tell us again how with that fourth and fifth step we dig down and get the garbage out and expose it so we can get rid of this thing that's holding us back? Can you tell us about that? He said, yes, I can, Clancy. And the rest of the room said, oh, shit. I didn't need them. I needed him. And I played him like a zither. And in 2 or 3 months, I was released from the hospital as a recovered alcoholic. And I never had another drink until I ran out of Thorazine. But when you're sensitive, you need a little something. I've often thought I ought to go back to Texas sometime and find that psychiatrist who classified me as a schizophrenic, some sort of a hideous dual personality. He must be about 90 now. I could move him around pretty good. You quack! Diagnosing me as a dual personality idiot, you ought to lose your license, for God's sakes. If I could have got my personalities down to two, I'd have made it. Yeah. My problem has always been this group that gets together in my head every so often. If something comes up, let's get out of here. Don't think we can. What do you think? I'm not sure. I used to hear people today say things like, I'm not sure the program's enough for me. I may need group therapy. I just go for a ride alone in my car. That's what's so good about alcohol. Alcohol reduces it to one voice. It may be a bad voice, but it's one voice. Why don't you quit your job and punch that son of a bitch in the face? But I didn't really want to stop drinking. That is why I stayed sober. I look back and think, what were the reasons? Did somebody have a special effect on me? Not really, I don't think. I think that I could give you a number of reasons of why it wasn't, but one reason I've come to conclude that I stayed sober was that I was lucky enough to be thrust into a group of AA fanatics. Tonight I would not call them AA fanatics. Tonight I would call them AA winners. If you're new, you'll hear that phrase a lot. Stick with the winners. Stick with the winners. Who are the winners? Well, you might think the people who've been here the longest. Sometimes they are, and sometimes they're not. I know old-timers in AA that whatever they had once, they've lost it. And they're old, sour, bitter, negative people. And I just say hello to them and I keep walking. So who are the winners? Well, in my opinion, based on these years I've been around AA, the winners are the people who came here, lost and desperate like we all did, allowed the program and its people to change their actions until eventually change their perceptions, and they are now people who on a continuing basis are sitting in these rooms. And they're looking for other people to come in and devote their time to helping those people find the same thing they found. Those are the winners. And you say, well, what's so good about that? For this reason, the winners are usually, nearly always, the activists in any group, in any area. Now, what's so good about being an activist? Well, when you come here and you got nothing going for you, you may attempt to be macho and brave, but you're really got nothing inside. And you'll discover that you will instinctively, as always do, like a chameleon, you will gradually take on the coloration of the people you're around. And little by little, if they're all doing things, you'll wind up doing them even though you don't intend to and have no reason to do it. I remember after being around that club for a while and be sitting thinking at night, thinking, how could I get some dough to get out of this town? This is a bunch of crap, this AA stuff, it's killing me. Come on, Clancy, we're all going to the meeting. Hop in the car. I didn't plan to go to that damn meeting. Come on, Clancy, we're going to help Fred move his furniture. Oh, shit. On and on, doing stupid things, and hanging in and doing things, because these people are all doing them. And I stayed sober. I stayed sober long enough till finally got to that next phase of sobriety, which is even more obstreperous to your human behavior. Time to get a sponsor. We all got sponsors. Get a sponsor. Guys, I've had sponsors. Tell you how to get a sponsor. If you want to be slick, find the most important AA in that town. Run into him and say, will you be my sponsor? Yes, I will. Then stay away from him. But whenever you go to meetings, people say, do you have a sponsor? Yes, I do. It's Dr. Bob. Oh. Here, take this seat in the front row. Let me get you some coffee. I've had sponsors. But I want to get a sponsor because everybody had a sponsor. I was sick of talking about sponsors. And there was this actor who used to come in and out. He was not a star. He was just a character actor. But I'd see him in movies. He always played loving, kindly roles, loving uncles or brothers or something, brothers-in-law. And he was always doing kind things in the movies. And I thought, God, maybe this guy will get my sponsor. I'll play him like a zither. Maybe I'll get some front teeth so I get a decent job, get a change of clothes, and get out of this stinking town. I said, Bob, would you be my sponsor? He said, yes, I will, son. But I want you to do what I say. Oh, sure, Bob. I've often looked back to that guy. He always played loving. He should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played. Because they were foreign to his nature, I'll tell you that. He turned out to be a right-wing fascist AA pig. See? No end to it. I want you to listen. Where's that? We're talking to him about sponsorship. Why'd you let me do that to you? I guess I somehow instinctively respected him for seeing through my crap, but I hated him for it. But because you have to let people intimidate you. He wasn't always mean to me. Once I remember talking a while back, and we talked about it earlier today, I've always quoted him and said, Clancy, you do that! Clancy, you do that! The guy came up to me in a meeting a few years ago and said, you know, Bob never talked like that. I knew Bob. He always talked to you in a modulated voice. He was an actor, he had a modulated voice. I thought, that's right. He may have talked in a modulated voice, but I heard him say, and he was, I mean, it was just, and I couldn't get away from him because I was always around that damn club living in an abandoned car, and he always could know where to find me. I couldn't go anywhere. If anybody went to me, they brought me back. And it was just terrible. I remember, the example I've used of our relationship in a microcosm, almost used and said it many times, it's still the best way to say it. One night I was over at a meeting in Central Hollywood, Friday night meeting, and had to stand there at the coffee break, and somebody give me a ride over, and I saw a woman in the second row I just hated. Jesus, I hated her. I couldn't do anything about it, but I was fantasizing, having the pleasure of fantasizing. Someday in a couple of years, I'm going to meet her on the street. I'm going to smash her face. I'm going to I'm going to drive her nose right into her brain. How do you like that, you? And that made me feel a little better. And all of a sudden, here comes my sponsor. Classy! So I want you to apologize to that woman. I thought, for Christ's sake, he can read my mind. Some kind of warlock. I said, why? He said, I was told that last night at the Frank Randall Group, you called her a bitch. I said this a little earlier today. I'll say it one more time. Try never to get sponsors that have spies everywhere. There's never a moment's rest. But Bob, she is a bitch. Says, why do you think so? She told her new girl not to go to bed with me. Well, she's right. You apologize. And I looked at her, and she could hear all this. And she's sitting there. And I thought, I would rather have needles stuck in my eyes than go over to Sam's. I said, Bob, I want to tell you, shut up and do it. And I just told him, I said, sorry, you rotten bitch. Jesus, just terrible. He said to me, I want you to go to that Tuesday night Hollywood meeting. Oh, Jesus, Bob, not that meeting. It's full of crazy people, Christ. Some of the men dress like women, and some of the women dress like men, and there's a guy there in an Arab costume with a burnous, and Bela Lugosi goes to that meeting, for God's sake. You know, if you doze off, you'll suck blood out of your neck right in the meeting, I've heard. I said, Bob, it's full of weirdos. He said, you'll fit right in over there. Move it. And I just told him, I said, and on, just terrible. Just terrible. I don't know how I stayed sober. But little by little, I did things. I stayed sober. And finally, a guy put me on the sofa. Got out of that damn abandoned car. And I slept on the sofa for a couple of weeks. There's a young single guy. Then one morning, about 3 a.m, there's a tap at the door. He went to the door. He came over. He said, Clancy. He said, would you mind? My girlfriend's at the door. I haven't seen her for a while. Would you mind taking a little walk for a couple hours? Just, you know. And I was offended by this. I was tired. I said, why don't you ever hit the street? She's more used to it than I am. And so that night I was back in my abandoned car. Somebody else put me in their sofa. Their wife got mad at me because I put out cigarettes under the sofa because the ashtray was way over there. And I had a lot of heartaches, I'll tell you that. But I stayed sober. By the time I was 6 months sober, I had several little jobs, terrible jobs. I mentioned this earlier today, too. You know, I remember going to Bob when I was relatively new. I think, Bob, I'm hungry a lot of the time, and I don't feel good, and people treat me badly, and I have no decent clothes, and I have no place to stay, and I'm living in an abandoned car. What do I do? He said, get a job. I said, Jesus, Bob. Look how terrible I look. He said, get a terrible job. I followed that direction, I'll tell you, again and again. I was about 6 months sober, and I was out of work, and I was back in that damn abandoned car again. And the guy put in some clout for me, got me a job as a dishwasher at the Gaty Delicatessen. And I lasted there about 2 days. I got fired because I didn't do the dishes because I felt they were using me. And I said, I might as well kill myself. I might as well kill myself. Why should I have to stay alive like this, you know? Christ, even the people got sober when I did get jobs. And I can't hold a job as a dishwasher. And I used to be something. I decided to just walk in the ocean. I always been kind of dramatic, like Frederick March and Stars Born, just, and I'll be sorry later. I couldn't find the ocean. Christ, what a day. I walked, just walked and walked, and I finally couldn't. I just stopped the gas station. I said, where's the ocean? He said, you're just in Western Beverly Hills. You have to go out past the Veteran Hospital, then about three or four more miles. I thought, well, screw that. You know, I don't mind dying, but I'm not going to walk myself to death. And I decided, it's so bad, I'll call my sponsor. I didn't want to ever call him with bad news because he was so testy about that. I said, Bob, this Clancy. I thought, before I called him, I thought, I used to be a good writer. I will tell him a story that is so sad and touching that even his heart will be touched. And he'll come down, maybe give me some more and get me out of dough. Give me some dough and get me out of town. I said, Bob, this class. He said, why aren't you working? Bob, let me explain. I've lost my family, and I've lost my children. I'll never see them again. I won't maybe ever have a decent job again, but that's all right. I'll have a good life somehow in AA. But there's something you don't know, Bob. Of all the things you don't see in my life is this. Even in AA, people treat me differently. They treat me badly. I'll go to a meeting again and again. They'll call on me once and never call on me again. I don't know why. They're jealous of me or something. I go to the club and sit and have a cup of coffee. People get up and move to a different table. People, after a meeting, they're going to a party. They won't tell me. Old-timers tell their babies not to hang around me because I'm a loser. Bob, even in AA, it just isn't working. What'll I do? And I suddenly realized, this is true. Jesus Christ. The saddest story I could think of was my own. And I burst into tears. I said, what do I do? He said, why don't you write your damn inventory the way I told you? Last week he told me to write my inventory. I'd explained to him, I've taken my inventory with a psychiatrist. Why would I take an out-of-work actor? And that made him cross. But Jesus, Bob. In my judgment, that's the last thing in the world I need is to take me all that remorse. He said, in your judgment, who cares about your judgment? You live in an abandoned car. If I wanted your judgment, I'd come down and put my head in the back window and ask you for it. He got me so upset that I came out of that, just crazy out of that phone booth, that rushed to the club, got some paper, and wrote an inventory. Something I swore I'd never do, and put in terrible things, hideous things, and things I'd never told a soul and would never tell my psychiatrist. We were talking about that earlier today. Somebody said, why wouldn't you tell your psychiatrist? Because when you're paying that kind of money, you can't risk rejection. That's why. You did what, sir? Get out of my office. You're filthy. Yeah. Just like a good time, Doc. And I wrote this, and God, it made me feel just, when I got done with that, I felt worse than I had when I started. I thought, that doesn't work. That cheered me up a little. About a week later, I was feeling terrible again. He picked me up and took me along the ocean for 40 miles, gave me a flashlight, and I read this to him. And I just hated to read it to him, because it's just, oh, terrible stuff. But we got to Oxnard, he was yawning. I thought, and we're talking about sponsorship today, and I was just planning this. I've taken that trip over 200 times since then, on the driver's side, with some other boobs over there with a flashlight. I'm not sure I want to read this tonight. Just read the goddamn thing. Well, let me explain this part before I read it. And the odd thing about fourth steps and fifth steps are these. Honest, good fourth steps are always the same. They are always the same. I've listened to more Fourth Steps, I suppose, than almost anybody alive. And they're always the same. Lack of self-worth, guilt, fear, and occasional lashing out at the world to compensate for your feelings of inadequacy. In 1 week, I remember years ago, I listened to inventory of the daughter of one of the most famous human beings in the 20th century. And a week later, from a guy who'd been born under a bridge illegitimately in El Paso and just come out of prison. And their Fourth Steps were exactly the same. Entirely different in specifics, but those same emotions. Each result of that, I took a big step forward. You had me make amends later, and I made amends to a lot of people. And little by little, I stayed sober. I didn't do very well, you know. If you're kind of new and having a tough time, it's really hard to listen to AA stories because you hear people say, well, I was doing pretty well and I started drinking. My life went to hell. And I wound up in a terrible position. And I came to this wonderful program. I worked the steps. And today, I'm doing fine. That's just podium talk. That isn't the way life really is. It's all the same for all of us. You start drinking, things are pretty good. And they have a little ups. Well, I'm keeping even pretty well. Oh, Jesus. And one day you're out of it. And how did I get here? Then you come to A. I found the program, and it's wonderful. I found a new life. Oh, Jesus Christ. That's why we need each other so badly sometimes. And I stayed sober. I finally got a little job when I was a year sober. Wrapping packages in the back of an advertising agency. Same kind of job I'd had when I was 14. This is called the Rocket to Stardom program. Just, I was 2 years sober. I got a little job in a medical corporation. Finally, as a beginning writer. And I'd been a good writer, but I was able to get a job as a writer. And I felt good then because this was going to be a corporation. And I'd been sneaking away some money a little bit now and then. I told my sponsor, I said, Bob, I've got some money. I'm going to get some tea. He says, what about your kids in Dallas? I said, I send them money. Well, how come you got so much left? Well, Jesus, Bob, they all got teeth. Send them the goddamn money. So I went to work at that corporation carrying my lip like this. A lot of people didn't know I ever didn't have front teeth. I thought I'd been burned in the fire. But I went to work every day, and my sponsor in my first year there gave me some of the great spiritual advice I ever got. The great spiritual advice I got was holding a job and learning how to hold a job. I want to tell you some great spiritual contents. It's not in the book Alcoholics Anonymous. You think of spiritual lessons, you think of prayer and meditation, they're all very nice. But let me give you some great spiritual lessons to learn and to live in the world. Do what you said you would do. When you said you would do that. Be where you said you would be when you said you would be there, or let them know you're not coming. Don't take out your hostility on people who can't answer back. Employees, waiters and waitresses, children. If you must take out your hostility, find somebody big that's able to knock you right in your ass and tell them. And you'll find it's not so necessary to tell them after all. On days when you realize you're having a bad day, and we all have those days, watch your mouth, because you can just cut people to ribbons those days, not even be aware of it. You got to, and on and on. I tell you, I learned some. I could never do them very well, but I survived on the job. And 3 years, when I was 5 years sober, I was director of advertising for that medical corporation, and I had front teeth, and I smiled at the drop of a hat. Hello there. If you're new and having trouble with your teeth, let me give you some hope. When you become spiritually perfect, they grow back. When I was 7 years old, when I was 6 years sober, I was brought into a firm called Revell, a big toy manufacturing company. And I was in charge for a while of their packaging. I created a Revell sweepstakes where some kid won a real jet plane, surplus of the Navy, Army. And I really enjoyed that because as you can tell, I still have rather immature ways sometimes. I As I was telling someone the other day, I haven't had a happy childhood, but sure as hell been a long one. But I could be able to walk through my department and tell people, I want the box art on this done, the painting done, talk to the painters, get the story of the trades, let's get this artwork and really get going now. I could go in my office and shut the door and take one of our little planes and go. And when I was 7 years sober, another guy and I were brought into Hollywood. We created something called Boss Radio. Became the number one hard rock station in the world. And we all wore shiny suits and said things like, what's coming on down, baby? But you get sick of pimping to teenagers. When I was 10 years sober, I was downtown doing public relations for an oil company. 15 years sober, I was a marketing director in Beverly Hills. When I was 5 years sober, that same Catholic wife and all those Catholic children heard the crinkle of green in my pocket all the way to a post office box in Texas, leaped out of their post office box, rushed to my side, attached themselves to me like a group of starving chiggers. 9 months and 10 seconds later, another Catholic hit the street. They're all grown up now. I probably would have had more, but somebody introduced me to the rhythm system finally. Sure beats the hell out of coitus interruptus, whatever the hell that is. Makes you edgy, is what it does. Anyway, so now all my kids are grown up. Three of them are in AA. The rest of them aren't. The ones that need to be in there are there. They all got 8 years sobriety. They all got sober in 1979 or 89. And I live in a house out by the ocean in Los Angeles. Been married to the same woman now for next month. It'll be 49 years. Whoa. Yeah, you bet. I've never been so happy. And the job I have now, I've had for 25 years almost. I'm doing very fine. Is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety at all? You are back there? Let me tell you two young folks something. I think it'll make you feel better. I've got it all together, and you haven't. But I know you're very happy for me. All these things I've told you are true, but I want to just for, that's kind of introduction. I want to talk to you two people, kind of, for about 5 or 10 minutes, then we'll be able to get out of here. I know we all want to get back outside in the parking lot and look for our car. I want to get back and ride with Pat again. He said to me this morning, you're not afraid, are you? And I said, no, but my laundry man will find out different. Probably the most important thing I've said tonight, or I've said a long time ago, nobody paid any attention to. I said, my name is Clancy Immelsland, and I'm an alcoholic. When did I become an alcoholic? I was an alcoholic when I drank. I was an alcoholic when I got sober. When did I become an alcoholic? I'll tell you, I stayed sober some time, knowing I wasn't an alcoholic, but doing these dumb things. As a result of staying sober and being surrounded by fanatics and going to hear speakers and hearing good speakers and doing these things, it gradually began to sink into my head something that I could not understand. All of my life, I know I can't be an alcoholic because my problem really isn't alcohol. It is when I'm drunk, and I can say, yes, my problem, but I know it isn't. There's too many other things going on wrong inside of me. And I finally discovered from my betters here that is exactly what AA says. It says, my problem is not alcohol. Now, if you're kind of new, you might think, what do you mean the problem isn't alcohol? Everybody knows the problem is alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. They don't. Jails turn out recovered people. They don't. They all turn out sober people. Incidentally, I was telling this the other day. One more. I haven't said this for 25 years, but a guy came up to me in a meeting Wednesday night, half drunk, said, "Clancy, I just can't get off of this one. I can't afford to go to a treatment center. What can I do? I'm willing to do anything." I gave him a solution that always works, but they never follow it. I said, "Slap a cop." Worked for me. You'll now be off this drunk for some time, actually. But if people like me, and I presume like you, you come to discover stopping drinking is a great thing. But unless something happens after that, sooner or later, people like me, and I presume you, will eventually always have to drink or sedate. Well, if the problem isn't alcohol, what the hell is it? Is it something like Scientology? We have to send in, get new tapes or new literature every month, or find ways to bond? Nope. Everybody in this room knows what's wrong with them, but they may not realize they know it. The problem here sounds like alcohol, and we keep getting it confused. But the problem here is something called alcoholism. You say, alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Significantly different. I'll guarantee you, if you be like me, the day must come in your life where your sanity and survival will depend upon remembering the difference. So that begs the question, well, what's the difference? Well, I could talk about that for 2 hours. I did once. Wasn't anybody left when I was done. But I could put it in one sentence tonight. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and cleaning up your act and straightening out. However, in this strange thing called alcoholism that looks like an alcohol problem, this mind-consuming, sanity-threatening, bodily-destroying, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered it yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you can't stand it. That is what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. Not that you can't get sober, not that you can't go to classes and learn all sorts of things, but eventually sobriety gets more painful than drinking. No matter what drinking has done to you, it represents relief. And that is one half of alcoholism. The other half was equally foreign to me because I wouldn't have guessed it. You must be one of the 7 or 8, 9% of people, as far back as they can determine in every generation, you see, about that many people, nobody knows why, who get an unnatural reaction to alcohol. And the worst thing about it is, you never know it's an unnatural reaction because you have nothing to compare it against. I cannot compare my reaction to your reaction. It's like somebody saying to you, "Do strawberries taste unnatural to you?" I don't know. They taste like strawberries. That's all I know. I don't call it unnatural reaction. So the question is, how do you know if you've got this unnatural reaction? What is it supposed to do when you hear these guys say, "I stayed drunk around the clock for 25 years. You think, that's the unnatural reaction. Not at all. We talked about this earlier today. No human body can stay drunk 2 weeks in a laboratory. One of the curses of being an alcoholic is you keep getting sober again and again and again and again. Well, maybe it's that you do crazy things. We hear these circuit speakers say, "Then I was the penitentiary, then I went to Mayo Clinic, then I went to Menninger's, then I went back to the penitentiary. In my work today, I see alcoholics like you and me die. And some of them have never acted crazy once. They get more and more withdrawn till they're almost catatonic, till they die. I sometimes see people who have to ask someone put a mirror in front of their mouth and see if they're dead. See if there's any breath. So what is this unnatural reaction that's so baffling? It's something that is so simple, I never would have guessed it in 1,000 years. The unnatural reaction of alcohol in the alcoholic body is to almost instantly make everything all right. That's all. To change my perception of reality, to alter my relationship to my environment. And it turns out, it doesn't do this for most people. I didn't know that. That's why they don't drink. It isn't because they're spiritually or morally superior. It's that when they drink, they get a little dizzy and they get tiddly sometimes. They get warm and then they get dizzy and get sick. And that's why I could never understand, why don't they drink? And they will never be able to understand fully why I do drink. But drinking to me does something special. And it's great. It's better than drugs. It's better than anything. I was talking earlier today about, I'm not an addict, but I've been working with addicts for 25 years. I know a lot about heroin and cocaine. I know where you get to heroin and why you have to overdose when you get to cocaine. And now this goddamn crack that's just so hideous. And what a hideous thing that is. But alcohol just makes you more, makes you something. The trouble with it is this. If it does this for you, it then makes it lethal. Because if alcohol doesn't do something special for you, it will never do anything to you. Because the minute it starts to act badly, you quit. But when you come to depend on it to relieve the conflicts of life without even being aware of it, eventually you quit. And you discover life is painful. It wasn't the drinking at all. It's all these things. And you drink. Pretty soon drinking, you can't drink and you can't stay sober. Drinking is bad. Sobriety is bad. And you go back and forth. And you could be on Skid Row, where I've got seen guys who are still making $1 million a year. I've been on a 12-step call where the butler took me to the inside maid, took me to a luxurious bedroom with an Oscar on the wall and New York Theater Critics Awards in the bed, a little huddled figure with his teeth out so he wouldn't choke. And he felt as bad as I ever felt. So what is it? What is it? That phenomenon is called alcoholism. You can't drink successfully, and you can't stay sober successfully. And that's why so many people like you and me die from it, because they get sober and say, I'm sober, and I don't feel any better. I don't know any long-term drinker who hasn't tried AA, and who doesn't say, well, I tried AA, but it doesn't work for people like me. I went to some meetings. And they never realize that they never have tried AA at all. The problem here is not how to get sober. The problem here is how to stay sober. And these people say, well, I tried AA, but Christ, it was worse than I was drinking. And they never realize. That's exactly right. You've just defined alcoholism. That's why today in America, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, it is estimated about 95% of alcoholics still die drunk. Or as a direct result of drinking. I think it's safe to say a number of people in this room will die drunk. Maybe me, maybe you. The sponsor that taught me that eventually died drunk because he stopped doing the things. And it isn't that AA doesn't work, but you stop doing the things that keep it from working. And I've never seen such a... This is the most denial-prone illness in the world. Over the years, I've had maybe three people, I guess, who I sponsor have died of cancer to UCLA Cancer Hospital. That's a dreary ward because they're all dying. It's the hospice end. And when they're I hate to go there after work, but that's what sponsors are supposed to do, I guess. But sit there, this one guy, Ramon Pena, and watch these people come and go dead over here, dead over here. Next week there'll be somebody new to. I remember thinking one day, he was sleeping, I was thinking, what would these people in these beds do if I came in here one day and said, hey, got a deal for you. Would you come with me every night at 8 o'clock? We'll go meet some new people, drink some coffee, have some fun, make some friends, hear some interesting people. Would you do that if I could cure your cancer? Yes, yes, take me. Oh, yes, yes. They'd sign over their house to you because they know they're going to die. Maybe the worst place I've ever been in my life, not because it smells bad or looks bad, it just is terrible, is the Los Angeles County Hospital Charity Ward for AIDS, where not only are they dying of AIDS, but they've been thrown away. And you go in that ward, because the guy I sponsored was in that ward dying, and I went in there to see him, and it's clean, smells like disinfected, but it must have been the way leper colonies used to look, just open sores and sick, pathetic, and no way out, they're going to die. I remember thinking, what would these people say if I said, hey, got a deal for you. Would you do some things, whether or not you agreed with them? Would you turn over your evenings to me, and would you eventually write some things, all the dirty, rotten things you've done, and would you come with me and we'll go to the people you've hurt and make it good and take some actions, maybe come to believe, maybe even try to pray and do some of these things. Would you do that if I could cure your AIDS? They would crawl across the floor and lick your feet. Say, take me, oh my God, take me. But you go down two floors to that same hospital, and you go to that ward, and there's a guy with a liver out to here, his eyeballs yellow and his skin's yellow, and he will not go to that AA meeting because he's not an alcoholic. And you come back next month, and he's dead, and there's a new guy there who's not an alcoholic. Now, if guys 3 days away from death from acute alcoholism can still prove they're not alcoholic, you and I can do it very easily. That's why it's so necessary to come to understand the nature of the problem. The problem here is not alcohol, but it includes alcohol. It turns out that alcohol does too much for me. It has required me to be dependent on it, which has enabled me to not deal with the problems in reality till finally get so bad I can't stand either one. And that's why people come to AA and sit here for a few meetings and learn all the words and wonder, why don't I feel better? Start with this premise. Getting sober is not the point of AA at all. Getting sober is the point of detoxes and toilets and hospitals and places, but not AA. Being sober is the entrance to AA. And when they talk about being sober, at least where I was taught and when I teach other people, you can do whatever you want to. That means you're not getting off alcohol. You're getting into reality. That means you don't take other things that get you goofy either. All the arguments in the world why you should take antidepressants, you're fine to do it. But anybody that I sponsor, you start your sobriety over again, because we're trying to learn to live in reality. And after you're in AA a while, it's kind of fun, and after a while it starts to pall on you. It gets a little tiresome. I've heard all the talk, and Jesus Christ, this is a little dreary months now, this. And one day it starts to get pretty bad. Now, you better try AA. AA is surrendering your judgments, allowing someone hopefully to superimpose actions, because it turns out that's what AA is all about. Not knowledge, not learning, it's changing actions. And it's hard to explain because all of us have been pretty well inculcated by therapy. And therapy says, you come to us, we will change your thinking, and eventually your actions will change. And AA, these well-intentioned amateurs, they say, well, you come to us, we will change your actions, and eventually your thinking will change. I say, no, that's wrong, you dummy, that can't be right. It's hard to realize these amateurs have got rooms full of sober alcoholics all over the world, and I've been in a lot of them. And these therapists don't have one room full of sober alcoholics in the last 70 years. So it turns out action. That's why the book says specifically, a magic word. Not love, not tolerance, not prayer, not God. Action is the magic word. Without that, your perceptions are going to be distorted. And it says also, as you stay sober a while, there's something else you must do. When all else fails, what do you do? Meditate? God, no. Pray? No. When all else fails, you work with another alcoholic. You don't have to be their sponsor. You don't have to be a wonderful old-timer. You just do something to get that sick mind off yourself. Again, I repeat myself a little bit from this morning. But when I think about that sick puke, I'm not thinking about this sick puke. And that's just like a letter from home with a check in it, I'll tell you, just to get away from that for a while. And that's when you begin to understand that's what alcoholism is. Then you can understand why sitting around being sober doesn't make you feel better. The natural state of sober alcoholics is growing anxiety and depression, unless you do something that overcomes it. And I don't care how well you know the words, you got to learn the music, and the music is the action. And that's why I stayed sober, I suppose. And I'm not what you'd call an excellent example of AA, because after almost 40 years, I still get emotional sometimes. But that's why they talk about you deal with these things. Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired, for example. No matter how long you've been sober. Why is that? Because they make you bad? No. I stay the same, but people around me turn bad. Yeah. When I'm hungry, they get stupid somehow. Come on, hurry up. Get going here. When I'm angry, sometimes God wants me to kill them. For their own good. When I'm lonely, I know they're all at a party somewhere, but they didn't tell me, did they? After all the help I've given them, too. When I'm tired, people know you're tired and they attack you. I don't know how they know. The example I've used many times, I live out by the ocean in Los Angeles. I drive Highway 10 downtown, Santa Monica Freeway, and I go to work. And I've learned to disguise fatigue. Nobody knows. Maybe I drove to Indio last night and come back, and I get on the freeway and I'm tired, but nobody knows about it. But they know. You just see some little old lady up around La Cienega saying, "See the boy in the gray caddy? He's exhausted. I'm going to cut that son of a bitch off." And then I've been known to chase them. But the thing AA has now taught me, you don't have to chase people past your exit. If you haven't caught him by then, you say, "Good flying, Red Baron. We'll meet again someday." And if you do catch him, there's nothing you can do. You can't cut him off. You have to just give him a ray and drive by him. Makes you feel a little better. A few years ago, I was coming off the Santa Monica Freeway into the Harbor Freeway, and some little girl in a car cut me off and almost put me in the overpass. I'll tell you, I missed that by a 16th of an inch. And I decided she needed counseling, so I made an exception in her case and went by my off-ramp. And I caught her in the Pasadena Freeway, and I gave her a quadruple ray. And I suddenly realized, geez, what am I doing? Here's this little girl, about 17 years old, long blonde hair, looking like my granddaughter, Katie Doherty. And here she is. What kind of a guy am I? You know, chasing this little girl, trying to learn how to drive. She's doing the best she can. What kind of a guy have I turned into? And I smiled at her. And she went, "Easy, trust me." Those are things you face out there in the real world, folks. But you learn to live with them. And you never become wonderful. You never become terribly serene. But you get some degree of living. I've often thought what alcohol did for me. It took a person like me who never felt like I was quite enough. It made me feel like I'm enough. And over a long period of time, I believe AA is designed to do the same thing. To little by little, very slowly, make me feel like I'm enough. And I feel like I'm enough most of the time. I don't, not all the time. I used to wonder, why don't I feel like I'm enough all the time? God, I work the program, help people, and so on. And I suddenly realized, no human being feels like they're enough all the time. It's part of being a human being. The reason I drank alcohol, it helped me overcome my instinctive knowledge that I was going to be rejected and just hate to... I used to hate, when I was sober, I'd hate to ask my wife to dance even. She might say, "No, not now." And I'd go, When I drank, it all changed. I'm sure most of us, some of the guys in this room know this experience, sitting in a bar late at night, having a few drinks, thinking about how they're screwing you around down to work, and brown nosers are getting ahead, people of integrity are being held back. As you have a few drinks, you suddenly notice a miracle takes place in front of your eyes. Some old beast gradually becomes beautiful. I might sidle over such an old beast at closing time and imply there will be delights beyond her comprehension if she'd like to join me in the old Chevy. If she would say, "No, God, if I were sober, I'd just cut my wrist right there." But I wouldn't be there asking the question about sober. I've had a few drinks, it's all different. She says, no, I don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch, don't come begging tomorrow. That's why I drink. Alcohol is designed to do these things for me. So the purpose of AA is to very slowly do these same things, but it happens so slowly you don't even know it's happening. That's why they said, I promise you, you learn to get along with people. Why? Because you're not so sensitive all the time. Your feelings aren't being hurt every 20 minutes. It's just little by little it happens. But that's what the best thing that ever happened to me is I discovered there's a name for my unnatural condition. It's called alcoholism. And there's the answer for it is here. I hope you two folks in the 30 days, under 30 days, listen to that because it may help you a lot down the road when you start to feel uncomfortable in AA. You have to realize you may need a sponsor that's going to have you take actions. You don't. If I could think of one thing that's most important to stay sober, if you're new, it's just this. Do things whether you agree with them or not. Because everybody's willing to do something they agree with. But when you don't agree with it, it seems stupid, and your sponsor's telling you, that's nonsense. To do it anyway. That's the dividing line. The last thing I want to say now before I sit down is I want to tell you that it hasn't all been peaches and cream. Right about 15 years sober, I was working downtown in Beverly Hills in this publishing firm. And in some hideous fit of I don't know what, I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills and taking a job running the Skid Row mission I was thrown out of 15 years before. And I've been there for 25 years now, running that stinking mission. And people say, why would you want to give up your good advertising career to run this damn mission? And I could never find an answer for that. I think, well, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it must be spiritual. But it isn't. And it's not a treatment center, nothing like that. Way below that. We're trying to keep people alive. When I go to Monday morning, I'll get in my car and but of the ocean, I'll drive. My car still wants to get off the freeway. It's Beverly Hills, you know, and I have to wrestle it. No, I can't stop. My car wants to go to that office where I used to be able to walk in and pretty girls in tight sweaters would say, here's your coffee, Mr. Immersland. Anything else? I don't want to go downtown, and what I'll see at my desk is who died over the weekend and who smashed their head to the sidewalk and which crack addict finally had one crack to hit too many. And so which frightened illegal alien Mexicans shoved a knife in somebody because they were afraid. And on, just a river of misery. God damn it. It's really teasing. I think, what the hell am I doing here? But on the other hand, I have a staff of 120 men. Some of you have been in that mission. Bill has. 120 men, and every one of them have been declared absolutely hopeless by the Department of Social Welfare. And they're all doing good, because they don't even know it, but they're doing AA, they're acting. They're acting themselves better. And they've not rehabilitation, habilitation. They're learning how to live for the first time. And a lot of peer pressure on them. I don't give the pressure, but there are guys around them do. And we are able to get to people sometimes on that street that nobody's ever got to. And every so often we get somebody off that street that they swear can't be off that street. And so when I go home at night sometimes, I feel like I've done something today. We've made a little bit of a difference. Not a hell of a lot, but a little bit of a difference. And I feel like I'm something, more like a man than I ever did. Coming down those elevators in Beverly Hills every day, popping my fingers and being hip and slick and cool. So it does have a positive side. But I want to tell you new people here tonight, I don't want to give you the wrong impression. Even if you get a sponsor, even if you go to meetings, even if you eventually work these steps and take actions and try to help others, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. You know, there's only so many go around. I got mine, and I think I can guarantee you that you'll walk with some degree of dignity in the world, and you'll live with some degree of self-confidence. And you won't feel wonderful all the time, but no matter what happens, you know that it's just a passing thing. It's amazing after a while how few big deals there are. There aren't many big deals, I'll tell you. I haven't seen a big deal in a long time. And you ride with the punches and you survive, and some days you feel crappy and you say, come on, midnight, and get that goddamn day out of the way and keep going. And when that day comes, it's worth everything it took. And that's why people can get up and say, I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. I don't know what would have happened to me if I'd have been the way I was and drinking didn't help me. I would have been a crazy son of a bitch and I'd be in deep trouble to this day if I were alive. But instead I have some degree of reason for being. Over a period of time in AA, I came to believe that God loved me. God, I never thought that would happen. I came to get along with my parents. I came to take care of my children. But all of this is secondary to one thing. I'm able to live in the world now that is not an enemy foreign world. It's a world I understand, and as long as I keep coming here, I will live in it comfortably. And you two young folks who are new and all the rest of you, I hope you'll stay here and try it. It's well worth everything it took. Thank you.